You're listening to The Music Show on RN Radio Australia and online. It's Australian Music Month, and one of the most successful and awarded of Australian composers in the last 10 years is Brett Dean. He's won a lot of awards, including the Gravemeyer Award 4 years ago for his violin concerto, The Lost Art of Letter Writing. And indeed, that piece has just appeared on CD on the Bis label. His opera, Bliss, appeared in 2010, and most recently, as I mentioned, The Last Days of Socrates. But we talked to Brett Dean back in 2006 about his origins, really, as a composer, which began playing the viola in the Berlin Philharmonic in Karajan's orchestra. I asked him what that felt like.
Well, I mean, at the risk of paraphrasing Little Britain, it was gorgeous. You know, it was really a fantastic experience. And I mean, in the early years that I was there, you know, sometimes I'd have to pinch myself that it really wasn't some sort of dream. And you know, it was a real eye opener too to see, I don't know, the business of music at that level. It was also incredibly challenging for somebody in their first orchestral job, because the rate at which programs were learnt and performed was quite daunting at first. And you know, until you get a certain amount of repertoire under your belt and start playing pieces for the second and the third time and feel more relaxed with them, that you know, took a couple of years to get into the swing of it. But it was an experience that was obviously incredibly formative from a playing point of view initially, and playing chamber music as much as in the orchestra itself with some, you know, truly extraordinary instrumentalists. But also, you know, it taught me a lot about composing and orchestration and all sorts of things. And as the composing sort of loomed larger in my life in the last few years that I was there, it was also a wonderful resource of again, incredibly gifted soloists and instrumentalists that I could consult with.
Yes, and to have those people as your mates that you could write for like kind of a composer's dream, isn't it?
It really, you know, it was in many ways. I mean, writing for the 12 cellos or the 8 horns, I mean, you know, it was very special.
What about the sense of tradition? I mean, presumably, if you were there, what, say you would have gone there in 1980?
I joined, my first concerts there were in 84 as a casual, while I was just finishing my first year of studies in Berlin with Wolfram Christ, who at the time was the principal viola. And I auditioned and got the job in the middle of 85 and started the following season, which was, you know, the end of August of 85, and was there then for 15 seasons.
Well, there must have been in the mid-80s, there must have been people in that orchestra who played under Furtwängler.
There were indeed. I mean, look, it was a bit of a freak out for me in some ways too, because it was such a different world. I mean, you know, I was still among the first players that came along and didn't wear a suit to rehearsals. And then when I, you know, turned up in loud shirts and braces and you know, short punkish hair, and then when they saw my wife Heather with red punk hair, you know, they kind of thought, my God, what's going on here? Is this really, you know, the right thing for the Philharmonic kind of thing? But you know, they accepted me for who I was, and you know, I think there was a thawing effect going on then anyway, because the orchestra was just getting so much younger almost on a weekly basis. And the time I joined in the orchestra was the beginning of a real turnover in the ranks. But it was also incredibly special to then glean some wisdom from some of those older players, and none more so than a man called Siegbert Überscheer, who I sat next to in the viola section quite frequently in that early time, and who was a real sort of father figure to me. And I'll never forget my very first rehearsal, and of course the orchestra plays notoriously behind the beat, particularly pizzicato chords and things like that. They're an absolute bloody nightmare if you're not used to it. And he just sort of showed me how to breathe with the overall sense of phrasing that's sort of inherent particularly within the string section, and also to wait for the bass section. It's sort of, you know, a pizzicato chord there is a little like a giant guitar. It goes from the bottom strings upwards, and you just have to then work out where you fit in that. It's a nightmare for Stravinsky, of course.
Yeah,
it really needs to be
on the beat. Together, yes.
It was sort of fascinating when you get somebody like Lorin Maazel, or later also Simon Rattle, obviously, who came from a different aesthetic, and you know, there was no question that the pizzicato chords had to be
together.
Absolutely together. And you know, the orchestra did display and you know, an amazing sense of flexibility.
But that's the Furtwängler legacy, presumably, isn't it? Because, I mean, I've seen footage of him conducting, and you see this kind of upbeat, downbeat, and then what looks like another upbeat. And somewhere in there, what appears to be halfway through one of his beats, the orchestra comes in together.
Oh,
and you think, how did they do that?
How'd they do that? Yeah. I mean, the thing was that, you know, when I first played there, when I first joined, it was, you know, from the outside, of course, still very much Karajan's orchestra. And you know, he was an empire. But, you know, spending more time there and speaking with the players over time, you realise how much of the sound and so on came from Furtwängler's time with the orchestra, certainly.
You became a composer while you were there, as if, you know, you didn't have enough to do sitting in the middle of the Berlin Philharmonic. How did that come about? Because you're, you know, a notoriously late starter, aren't you?
Yeah, well, viola player, we're always, you know, thought of as being a bit slow. Yeah, I mean, it's ironic you say as if I didn't have enough to do. I guess probably as much as anything, it came out of a sense of having got over those first couple of years where there was a lot of repertoire to learn and so on. I got to a point where I thought, well, is this it? You know, what do I do now? I've done quite a lot of chamber music. I've played in this orchestra already for several years. And along came a family friend of my wife, Heather's, who came to stay with us in Berlin. And his name was Simon Hunt, and he was travelling to Berlin with a rock band from Sydney. And we got to know each other and started actually improvising together, and that sort of was the beginnings, really, of my interest in composing, which had been there when I was studying in Brisbane to some extent. But I'd always thought, well, composing is for composers, and I'm not a composer. I've never studied it, so I guess I'll have to do that in another life. But it was through, as much as anything, through Simon's enticing and inspiration that the composing thing sort of took hold.
Maybe we should listen to some of your music before we go any further. I mean, I've got questions I'd like to ask you about your music, but I guess we can't do better than to listen to the most recent thing, a piece called Vexations and Devotions, which you composed for the children's choir Gondwana Voices and the West Australian Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. We're going to hear a section called The Path to Your Door. Perhaps you could briefly set it up, and then we'll come back and talk about what we've heard.
Yeah, well, I've sort of described this piece in some way as a sociological cantata, and it's in three movements. It deals with aspects of alienation and aspects of the changing uses and misuses of language, and that's perhaps nowhere more apparent in the piece than in this last movement. What you'll hear the adult choir singing is a setting of a web-generated corporate mission statement in which the choir sings, you know, that sort of weasel word stuff that Don Watson has so delightfully dissected recently in a couple of books. They sing, for example, "We envision to assertively pursue world-class and high-yield solutions for innovative and market-driven 100% customer satisfaction." And, you know, it was my attempt to have a dig at the way language is turned into a machine, not only by the corporate world, but by the political world as well. And later on, at the end of the piece, that's sort of foiled by a setting sung by the children of a very beautiful poem by Michael Lunig, in which the children sort of play this role of trying to bring some sanity back into a relatively insane situation.
Yes, well, it's precisely that sort of language which seems to inspire the best of Lunig.
Definitely.
Let's listen to the music. This is from the final movement of Vexations and Devotions by Brett Dean. A section from the last movement of Vexations and Devotions, music by Brett Dean. And Brett Dean is my guest on today's music show here on ABC Radio National. Your pieces, Brett, are almost without exception about things, even the pieces that don't have words, which is most of them.
Do you
start with ideas about writing about things, or do you start with musical ideas and then hitch them to non-musical ideas?
It varies greatly, actually. I mean, in that particular case, there was a lot of motivic material already worked on before the final text was even clear, although I had a strong idea of what direction I was wanting to go. Originally, I was even thinking of using parts of the text from the middle movement of the piece, which deals with being kept on hold by an automatic answering machine service, which is, again, a text by Michael Lunig, but translating it into Latin and sort of turning it into a kind of Latin mass about thank you for holding, your call is important to us. And eventually replaced that idea with this idea of sort of taking on one of the aspects of contemporary misuse of English, in my opinion, and taking it on, you know, full frontal with a big choir and orchestra. But it really does vary. I mean, often the story behind it will be there first, and the music evolves around that. In many cases, the music is very much well underway until what it is about becomes apparent. And the titles, I think, for me, are a way of identifying with what the piece might be about or what direction it's going, without it necessarily being at all times programmatic particularly. They give me a way of, you know, sort of, as I say, identifying with aspects of the emotional world that I'm trying to deal with.
Brett Dean talking to me on the music show in 2006, and that piece of Vexations and Devotions is also on the new CD on BIS. You're listening to the music show on RN.